Hi, I'm Rick Schwartz.
Buenos dias, world. I'm Marco Wendt.
Welcome to Amazing Wildlife, where we explore unique stories of wildlife from around the world and uncover fascinating animal facts. This podcast is a production of iHeartRadio's Ruby Studio and San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance, an international nonprofit conservation organization which oversees the San Diego Zoo and Safari Park.
Ooh, Rick, I can't believe it. We are already a couple weeks into spring. And here in San Diego, the month of April, it's always that, you know, preview of summer kind of feeling.
Oh, I know what you mean, Marco. Perfect temperatures, blue skies all day, and all the animals at the San Diego Zoo and the Safari Park are just loving every moment. And I am too.
Yeah, right. And when this episode comes out, Butterfly Jungle will be in full flutter at the Safari Park.
Full flutter. Nice.
Thank you.
That's actually very true. Butterfly Jungle opened in March and will be available this year all the way to May 12th. So now is the time to go enjoy one of the more impressive seasonal experiences here in San Diego.
Oh, man, it is impressive, isn't it? When I was working there, I always loved how as soon as you walked in, you were immediately transported to this vibrant rainforest jungle habitat.
It's true.
Yeah, I know, right? And it's filled with colorful flowers and butterflies and, of course, those soothing bird calls.
You got to bring the birds in, don't you? Well, you're right, Marco. It really is something special, and the birds do add to the ambiance. Absolutely. And for anyone who was with us last season, you know we were able to speak to one of our wildlife care specialists in our entomology department last year about the mind-blowing steps a caterpillar goes through to become a butterfly.
Ooh, butterfly soup!
Yes.
But, you know, it's funny, I know, but, you know, just to clarify, everyone, for those who have not heard that episode from last season, butterfly soup is not a soup people eat.
True.
I mean, there will be no butterfly menudo here, everyone. Thank you very much. I mean, it was an analogy made to explain that the liquid inside the chrysalis is actually a caterpillar and will become the butterfly later on.
Yep, it's true. It's such an eye-opening conversation. Honestly, I think that episode has generated the most feedback from last season.
I mean, it makes sense to me. Who doesn't love butterflies?
Exactly. And although a lot of people love butterflies, not too many people know about the really amazing conservation work being done for them.
And, amigo, this is why we are heading to the San Diego Zoo to find out more about butterflies, butterfly conservation, and what everyone can do to help our fluttery friends.
I am Paige Howarth. I am the McKinney Family Curator of Invertebrates.
A lot of people are very excited. It's springtime. We've got Butterfly Jungle going on. But really, as much as Butterfly Jungle is wonderful and people can look at the butterflies up close, there's a lot more going on with butterflies and vertebrates in general, as you were sharing with us earlier. But with butterfly conservation, bring everybody up to speed. Where are we? What's going on with that?
Butterflies are and moths. Don't forget about moths.
And moths,
they are actually,
yes, sir. We cannot forget about the moths.
A much more significant group.
Well, let's get into that. Let's get into all of it. Yeah, let's do it.
They're a hugely important insect group. And given what we know about insects, it's kind of astonishing, honestly. We barely know anything at all about insects because insects are such a huge group. And of all the species that have been assessed, it's estimated that only about 1% of insects have been assessed. So every single bird that's known to science has been assessed for their conservation status.
Mm-hmm.
All the other vertebrate groups are very close to 100% assessment. And then when you look at insects, there's just this great unknown,
yeah,
which is challenging, disheartening, but also, you know, like something that we need to look at.
Let me ask real quick, as someone who I know has dedicated her life to invertebrates, we've known each other for a very long time and have,
yes,
always impressed with your work. Why do you suppose that is? Or do you know why that is, that it's only 1%, that it seems like this is a vastly overlooked, but yet so very important group of living creatures on this planet?
Well, part of it, I think, is a visibility thing. You know, it's much easier to care about pandas.
Right, right, right? Yeah, yeah. They're fuzzy, they're cute.
Not to go full
I get it.
Right at the beginning,
right?
but it's easier. They're adorable and their conservation status is important.
Right.
But insects are like doing all this dirty work. Most people don't see them. There's all these decomposers that are breaking down all this organic matter. A lot of these are species that people would not care to get close to, like cockroaches.
Right.
So there's also a PR problem. It's like, ugh, insects. You know, people don't engage as much with these animals. So in many ways, they're kind of like these silent partners just doing all the things and not getting thanked for it.
And to that point, I know there's a quote you've shared with me years ago about should these invertebrates go away, it's a matter of weeks till the planet basically folds in on itself, right?
Yeah, they're just the backbone of every ecosystem. So they're providing food. And I mean, the biomass of insects is staggering. So many things eat them. They're providing these decomposition services, pollination. Everybody right. is aware of how important right, pollination right. is. And really, bees are the heavy hitters for pollinating food for crops and things yeah. like that. And predation. I mean, you can't have all these millions and millions and millions of insects and not have something that's going to eat them as well.
Yeah, and, or parasitize might have them. Something to say about
I want to pull this fact. Like, it was such a cool fact. And we were talking about early, to your point, I was reading on our journal, by the way, there's a really cool article about pollinators. I hope everyone can read. But it says that a foraging grizzly bear can eat up to 30,000 army cutworm moths a day in the summertime. A big, large, carnivorous bear that is relying on the teeniest, tiniest little animal in that ecosystem, right?
Exactly. Moths, again.
Yeah, the moths. That's incredible.
What is it that you and our teams and our partners across California are doing right now for which species of butterflies and moths?
Well, we have a great partnership with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And, you know, in California alone, there's 16 federally listed butterflies or moths. Wow.
And federally listed means?
Under the Endangered Species Act. Right. So they're either threatened or endangered.
But most of the public doesn't even know we have that many butterflies yeah. and moths here, right?
In San Diego. Totally. And most people don't know that San Diego is this great biodiversity hotspot.
Yeah.
And so we're working with a couple of local species. One of them is the Kino checker spot butterfly, which is found in southeast San Diego and into Mexico. And then we also work with the Laguna Mountain Skipper, which is kind of an alpine meadow butterfly. There's only one population left wow. in the Palomar Mountain region. And so we're working to reintroduce that species to its namesake range in the Lagunas. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we pull in females that we think have mated during flight season, which is going to be within the next month or two for the skipper. And we bring them back to the Butterfly Conservation Lab, which is a dedicated facility that we have here at the zoo. We set them up, encourage them to lay eggs, and we rear those larvae to a certain life stage. Same for the Kino checker spot butterflies. They go into basically a period of diapause during the summer when
which
their host plants dry up.
What does diapause mean?
So diapause is a period of rest.
Yeah.
And the poster child for insect diapause is the monarch butterfly.
Right.
When they're in diapause, they're hanging in trees either on the coast of California for the western population or down in central Mexico for the eastern population. But for the Kino checker spot butterfly, it's the larva. And for the Laguna Mountain Skipper, it's the pupa.
Wow.
So it's different for every insect, which is also makes it really challenging.
The amount of species out there, right? That's crazy.
Yeah. So you can't just, we're doing head starting. And head starting is just kind of getting them to a certain developmental stage and then putting them out into whichever reintroduction scenario that you want to do.
Right.
But you can't just say, well, we know how to do Kino checker spots. You could say, we can do another checker spot very similarly, or a silver spot maybe. But skippers are a totally different family, and they have totally different life history. And so it's kind of like starting over every time.
Wow, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, I was just going to say a lot of work. But also, you guys, I got to point out the visual. Are any of you kids listening right now picturing these scientists out there? I'm picturing these like butterfly nets, you know, like maybe what we did as a kid. But this could be a job. Like, you got inspired, right? And apply this. And look at what you're doing right now. I mean, it's incredible. And by the way, we're in Paige's office right now. I'm looking around. There's so much cool stuff in your office. It reminds me of the colors and the vibrancy of insects, too. Like, you guys know I'm the bird guy, and I'm always hyping up animals that maybe don't get the platform. And I speak to that, and our reptile peeps say the same thing. But the underdog has got to be the insect crew,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. But just kudos to you and your team. Just the diversity of the animals that you work with is incredible.
Oh, and I have the best team. And I'm not just somebody who says, I have the best team. No, I do. And everybody is really committed to learning more, because everything we do here, not just butterfly conservation, but everything that we do, we have to create so many systems. We have to figure things out. Sometimes we have to figure out what the insects eat. Sometimes we have to figure out what they're going to lay their eggs in. Again, it's that great unknown, and that's what makes it so fun.
And temperatures and humidities,
yes.
And everyone's different.
And there's so many intervals where things can go wrong. You've got depending on the species, you've got up to like horseshoe crabs, you know, 16 or 17 molts. Okay, hope it works out, you know, every time. Because a lot can go wrong in between. That's a very vulnerable stage. Yeah. And so it's really a credit to kind of the tinkering and the curiosity and just wanting to learn more about these animals so that they thrive.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah. And anybody who's listening who has not been to base camp yet, you get a little bit of a taste of what Paige's team does when you go to the Spineless Marvels building. It is amazing on so many levels.
100%.
But I want to get back to the conservation of the butterflies. I feel like you talk about gathering. No, it's all right. It's all right. It's that's the beauty of storytelling.
We're fluttering all over the place.
Isn't it? Right? There you go. That's
I know.
Puns,
I'm learning,
man.
Rick. I'm doing it.
So we got to the point where your team has brought these different species in, get them to the different spaces where they need to be. What's the next step after that?
So we bring the females into the lab, and that's a pretty intense period of management because we want to make sure that they have everything that they need to be productive and to lay eggs, because that's the goal of this. And so we give them a lot of sunning sessions. We make sure that they have ready access to food and water, and then every day we go through their habitats and we pull out any eggs. And for Laguna Mountain skippers, for example, that's really, really difficult.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, how big are the eggs?
Yeah, I was going to say, how hard is it?
Let's start there.
So I have a picture of the skipper eggs on their host plant, Harcalia clevelandii.
Okay.
And I have I think it's a quarter right next to it. And, you know, there's the like "In God We Trust" inscription. Yeah. The egg will fit inside the O. of the god in the coin. So they're really hard to see. They're like kind of a cream color and they're laid singly.
Oh my gosh. Not even in clusters?
Not even in clusters.
Oh,
Kino make it easier. They lay their eggs in clusters.
Good.
And we're like, yes, thank you so much. So it's pretty obvious when you've got an egg cluster.
Cool.
But the skippers, So it's a completely different system for them.
Wow.
So we're searching for eggs. We're setting eggs up with the host plant. We set them up like pretty minimally so that it's easier for us to see what's going on. Like, so we don't have to always have a lot of used host plant to clean out. Because if you're looking for tiny caterpillars, it just takes 10 times longer if you have a lot of leaf material to go through. So it's this incredibly like painstaking and labor intensive thing. It takes a certain kind of person to want to do that.
Luckily, we have
a lot of those people.
I think it's those people who will finish a puzzle. Right. I want to point out.
Yes.
I am not one of those. But I feel that. I get that.
But we have some artists. We have some people that, you know, that are artists and entomologists.
Yeah. Right?
So again, just the skippers, I'm talking a lot about them, is that their behavior is really interesting. You know, when they're at a certain stage in their development, maybe like second instar. So instars are the developmental time between molts, basically.
Okay.
So their frass, which is what insect poop is called.
Frass. Can you spell that for us?
F-R-A-S-S.
Frass. Okay. Something. Okay.
So we're monitoring frass all the time because frass tells us that they're eating. Frass tells us when they start to back off of eating, if it's the checker spots, because when they start to back off eating, we know that they're getting ready to go into diapause and we start giving them different materials to hide out in.
That's cool.
And so for the skippers, they make these little sleeping bags out of their leaf material, right?
What?
So it's the host plant.
Uh-huh. That's
and
awesome.
They use silk to weave together leaves so that they can hide, and they do concealed feeding.
Oh.
So not only are they tiny, they don't want you to look at them.
They're tiny and they're shy.
Exactly.
The introvert of the butterflies.
Exactly. So the first season that we did the skippers, our team is looking for the head capsule, and the head capsule on the Laguna Mountain skipper larva is the only part that's hard. The rest of it is like a soft caterpillar, right? Mm. So that's the only part of the exoskeleton that's hard, and it's black. And at that stage, it's the same size as their frass.
Oh, jeez.
Oh.
So we have people, and we need to know. We want to know how long is it taking them to get from first to second instar, from second to third, all those things, because this is like really the first time we've been able to examine that in managed care.
Yeah.
So our team was going through and looking for head capsules versus frass under the scope just to tell if anyone molted that day, because you can't see inside the sleeping bags.
Wow.
You don't want to disturb them.
Right.
Yeah.
So again, it's like developing the methodology to know where you are and how you can either keep doing what you're doing or just pivot and do something different to move things forward.
I want our audience to realize what you're describing is you and your team basically are writing the book on how to care for these individuals and then how to get them back out in the wild. It's what you're saying is because no one else has done this. And so literally each part of what you just described is your team discovering how to do these things. And then just to your point, and if it doesn't work, we got to pivot. I'm sitting here, it's like, wow, it's like, you know, this is it. It's happening right here.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, for this species.
I'm so on the great unknown. You know, that's incredible to me because in the world, normally you think of like, there may be corners in the Amazon that's still undiscovered, but probably not. Maybe there is, or underwater, deep dive. But insects, I mean, that's really the great unknown, right? There's so much. And just kudos to the team and what amazing work you guys are doing for that.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, and it's not just us. There's other organizations and other places working with different species, and we all learn from each other.
Yeah.
For the skippers, there was kind of an in situ management trial that happened a few years ago. But there's really no substitute for having a group of people that are just devoted to that one thing.
Every single day, eyes on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we do all get, you know, like, hey, at Woodland Park, they're working with silver spots. Did you know that you can get an Oregon silver spot to unroll its proboscis if you dip its feet in water?
Huh.
Well, guess what? That doesn't work for checker spots.
But
you
we
have
tried.
To miss them.
Oh, you have to miss them.
You
oh,
have to miss them. You have to light miss them. So okay. It's like, again, you know, you have a handhold because somebody's done something with something similar.
Right.
And then you try to like mantle up on that and you're like, no, that didn't work. You're building this methodology with the help of your colleagues and partners, and you're moving in that direction.
So I'm glad you brought that up because it is, just like with the other conservation, Mark and I have talked to other people about, it's not just us, it's not just one team. It's a collective of people working together, sharing information. And that's so important, I think, for the world to understand that it's not a competition. We're all in this for the reason of conservation and saving these species. So thank you for bringing that
up.
Yes,
yeah, preach to that.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And I mean, not only the scientists, the researchers, all of us here in the Alliance and other collaborators, but the community too, right? We were just talking about things that the public can do. The obvious one is come to Spineless Marvels in Base Camp and visit that. It's my favorite spot at the zoo. Like, I love that we can offer this experience for everyone. But we were talking about some other aspects, right, that maybe people can do to help out insects in general. Do you mind bringing those up a little bit for our guests?
Sure. So I think the lowest of low-hanging fruit is don't use pesticides in your garden.
Yeah.
Okay. I think a lot of people think of pesticide problems that insects are experiencing are like agricultural problems like these broad application problems, which they are.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also this real issue with home gardening pesticide usage. And I think sometimes it's like, well, if I use a little bit more than the product describes, you know, I'll kill them extra dead.
They're not coming back this time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And I mean, I get it. Gardens are such a source of tranquility and peace, and they're so beautiful. But it'd just be such a great thing if everyone decided not to use pesticides or to use some organic alternatives to managing pests in the garden.
Totally.
And then along those lines, just returning your landscapes at your house back to native landscapes. You think about, like, California is incredible.
Right.
And you could say the same no matter where you are.
Right.
You will have incredible wildlife in your backyard. And they grew up with certain plants. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of a no-brainer to start making that transition. If you have a lot of exotic plants that require a lot of water and require a lot of pest management, think about what you can do to eventually transform that. We did this at our house, and it's like every spring, it's, oh, it's so exciting. What's going to happen this year? Because not everything comes up the same year.
Yeah.
And some stuff goes, whoa, it's all the way over there now, you know? You have all these surprises. But once you get those native nectar plants, especially nectar is so important to so many animals, you're going to start seeing your pollinators come in. Then you're going to start seeing your birds come in. And everybody else is going to be like, I belong here, you know? Because this is a native habitat. So that's one thing that I always tell people. It's so easy to do, and you're going to have a blast doing it.
Seriously.
And there's so many resources to do it.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like less work, you save money. It just makes sense,
save water.
Yeah.
And I want to go back real quick. The reason we think, well, pesticides, why that? In the general mind, I'm getting rid of pests.
Mm-hmm.
But it's worth noting that the chemicals that make up the pesticides, they have no discrimination. It will kill all insects and bugs. And one thing we had talked about before too, when it's used all the time in homes, sometimes overused, it ends up then getting washed away, goes into the neighbor's yard, goes into waterways, it gets into the storm drains, which go to creeks and rivers and the ocean. And we're finding now a lot of these pesticides and these chemicals that make them up are being found far, far away from where they were applied.
That's
they don't just break down and disappear. So that's part of the equation, is understanding that, yes, you're targeting what you consider a pest in your yard, but the pesticide is indiscriminate on who it impacts. And even birds like the hummingbird sometimes will be affected by these things as well.
That's right. And the systemic pesticides, like neonicotinoid pesticides, what happens typically is it's a coating on the seed. And so the seed goes into the ground, the plant grows up, and that pesticide is expressed in every tissue of that plant. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. So if you're a bee or you're a hummingbird or you're a butterfly and you're coming for nectar, it's going to be expressed in the nectar as well. Mm. If you're a songbird, neonicotinoids are having devastating effects on songbird populations as well. So it's just one of those things. It's like, you don't have to.
Right.
You know, if everyone just said, I'm not going to do that, it would make a huge difference.
Yeah.
Just the basics for like protecting wildlife and keeping our ecosystems, you know, intact.
Yeah, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah. And so it's a matter of paying attention to what you're putting in your garden as far as any sort of chemicals and things like that, but also what you brought in, which is great. Look at your native plants, the options there, because you're bringing in those birds and those butterflies and everything else. Let's say someone is in the pathway of the migrating monarch. Is there something they can do to help the monarchs out in their travels?
Nectar. Nectar is key.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had a really tough year for monarchs, for the eastern monarchs. This past season, they were down about 60%. It's the second lowest population 60%. Since they've been monitored for all these years. So nectar is really important. Obviously, it's important to have milkweed, of course. But often, you know, adults are searching for those resources when they're on their way down to Mexico and when they're on their way back laying those eggs. So that's super important. Just again, having a native garden, having plants that are going to bloom at the right time, the phenology or the timing of things is really important for butterflies and other pollinators. And with climate change, it's getting offset.
Yeah.
You know, and so things are coming up or not coming up. They're coming up early. And by the time the butterflies get there, that's it's already spent. So nectar is, that's another just no-brainer, just plant nectar.
Yeah, I mean, I remember being a kid in Escondido, in a town north of San Diego here, and just seeing those butterflies when I was a kid, and I just get so excited and troll around every year, but then there was a point I just wouldn't really see them anymore, and it was really heartbreaking, you know? And there was a time here you'd see hundreds and hundreds of monarchs flying over San Diego, but we're not seeing that any longer, so.
San Diego's changed a lot here, right? For sure. I mean, we still monitor overwintering sites here for Western monarchs.
Yeah.
But we typically don't see a lot of butterflies. I mean, I have a site here by the zoo that I do every year, and there's nothing.
Nothing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it's been like that for a really long time.
Yeah.
Some of the more northern sites there are, and there were butterflies in L.A. and Pendleton last year, which is great.
Oh, that's cool.
But we also have a resident population in San Diego, which complicates things.
Right.
Going back to the, like, what should I plant? There's a ton of great resources. The Xerce Society for Invertebrate Conservation has regional planting guides. So you just go and you can find where you live and what are the right things to have in your garden.
And what was that again?
Xerce's. It's X-E-R-C-E-S. And they're a nonprofit invertebrate conservation organization.
Excellent. Oh, thank you. That's a good resource. Yeah.
Yeah. There's also the Monarch Joint Venture, which is a collaborative. We're partners with Monarch Joint Venture and with Xerce's. And they have an incredible wealth of information just on monarchs.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
So people can visit and learn a lot there.
Cool.
And I was saying, come visit us too, right? I mean, we got Butterfly Jungle happening.
That's Safari, Safari Park. Yeah.
There's Plant Trader. There's a really cool native plant species out there that they sell, you know, so that could be an easy, go take the kids, enjoy the butterflies, get some native plants,
put them
in the garden.
There you go.
Yes.
Well, as we're starting to wrap this up, Paige, I just want to open up the opportunity. The last stages of the butterfly conservation, you talked us through the incredible detailed work your team has to go through. What's the other side of it? What are we landing on the other side of all this when they go back out into the wild? Or are we building a population in the zoo environment first? Or what is that last step for those butterflies?
So again, we're doing head starting, so we don't hold anything back for like a year-round breeding program at this stage. The Kino checker spot butterfly is, they lay a lot of eggs, and we are really successful in the lab at kind of getting a lot of eggs from them. So we have lots of larvae that we're managing. I was just doing a field check a couple weeks ago, and I brought this back in my binocular bag. So these are the vessels that we use to put them out in the habitat. So basically, I'm holding in my hand a finch seed feeder. It's a wire feeder. It's got a top that pops off.
It's a little bit bigger than a softball.
Yeah.
Inside of it is a peat pot. So those like gardening peat pots that kind of break down.
Yeah.
And they've got big holes punched in the peat pot. And then there's a date on it. So it says 2021 and 5 on both the top and bottom. And so we place the larvae inside the peat pots.
Okay.
And again, they're asleep, basically. They're in diapause. So they don't know
what's happening.
We try to do this we try to do this outside of fire season, but it's kind of like not ever
all
like
year
that anymore. So it typically happens in November.
Okay.
But what we want is for them to get all the cues in the habitat. So they have been safe in the lab for the first part of their life, and they've been in diapause
right.
for a couple months at this point. So we put them in the, we call these pods. These are the release pods. Mm-hmm. And we put them in the pod and then we wire them to a shrub in the San Diego National Wildlife Refuge at whichever site we're releasing on. And we have six sites right now for the Kino. And so they sit there until it starts raining. And they've been placed within a patch of Plantago erecta, which is their host plant.
Okay.
So we have partners from WildSpring Ecology that are doing the mapping. So Sean will go out and find the juiciest patches that appear to be like coming up for the host plant. And that's where we'll put the pods.
Wow.
And so we wire them in and then we just start monitoring them as the rain starts falling, the Plantago starts coming up and they start to leave the pods.
Oh, wow.
They wake up,
they molt, and they're like, okay, it's look, oh. I have everything I need right here.
Is it the rain that's triggering their movement, the behavior, or is it the flowering or the change in the plant that's triggering it, or is it both?
It's probably both. We don't know exactly. We can make this happen in managed care, too, mm-hmm. with moisture and host plants.
Ah, okay.
So they're emerging from the pods, and they're feeding, and we're monitoring their growth. And for Kino, some of them are going to complete their development at this point, so they're going to become adults themselves. Some of them are going to go back into diapause. And as a result of doing this work, releasing them in this way, because we check them after the season is over, after everything is dried and everybody's either dead or back in diapause, depending on if they matured or not, we know that they don't have to break diapause to survive.
Huh. Oh, really?
So we've looked inside these things and gone, hey, there's still some larvae in diapause in here over 2 years, which is crazy because they're only like 6 millimeters long.
2 years,
at release. So they have these strategies to deal with the unpredictable conditions in San Diego. It's hot, it's dry, we have fire, and it's kind of a cool bat hedging mechanism for them.
Yeah.
So that's the process for Kino. We rear them up, we hang on to them until we feel like it's safe to put them out into the habitat, and then we put them out in the San Diego National Wildlife Refuge. We monitor them after the season's over, and we count the abundance on the sites afterwards. For the skippers, it's been 2 years that we've been working on this, and we're still trying to figure out the best way to do it. So the first year, we reared them all the way to pupae, and we put them out as pupae in similar containers. The last time we did it, last year, we put them out as third instar larvae so that they could find their own places to kind of huddle up for their period of diapause because they make those shelters in their Horkalia host plant. They're really hard to find. And so, you know, releasing them as these little third instar larvae, because they need to make choices about like where they're going to pupate, and they live in this high elevation, which kind of flooded in June unexpectedly, you know?
Yeah, right?
So we have all these conditions that it seemed like it was better to let them make those choices. Kino make choices whether they're going to come out of diapause or not, but the skippers were still kind of trying to figure that out.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's rad. That's incredible. Good job, you guys. Kudos.
Thanks.
One last question I have to ask. I know we're probably asking for a little extra time for you, Paige, but hearing you describe all the steps and all the work your team does from gathering to everything in the butterfly lab to then setting everything up for release, all these different teams have to come together, the mapping of the areas. Why do this for a butterfly?
Butterflies and moths, like I said, are just such a huge critical component for all of our ecosystems. I guess I would say, if we know that we need to do something, we should do it.
Mm-hmm.
If we have the ability and the expertise, we have the partnerships, that's part of this. It's like there's so many more butterflies and moths in need, but maybe they don't have the habitat piece worked out, or maybe there's something else that's missing. This can't be done in a vacuum. We can't just like breed butterflies or rear butterflies and release them and just kind of hope for the best. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to have the partnerships and you've got to have all those other pieces working at the same time if you want to be successful. And with all the unknowns, it's going to take a long time.
Yeah.
We've been doing Kino for 8 years.
Yeah.
We're still tweaking it. So I think the question to me is more like, why wouldn't you do that?
100%.
You know, especially if you're thinking about like how little we know about the world in general, but especially about insects. And if we know something and we know we can do something, then Why wouldn't we turn away?
Yeah. Why wouldn't you? I love that. Thank you so much, Paige.
Yes.
Thank you. I appreciate your time today.
This is so fun.
So enlightening.
Love it. I learned a lot today. So thank you for that. I appreciate you.
Well, it was so fun being here with you guys. Thank you.
You know what, Marco? I love that every time we talk to someone about butterflies on our team, we learn even more.
Man, I know that's right. I could listen to Paige talk about butterflies and invertebrates all day.
True.
And like when she mentioned how little we know about all the invertebrates on the planet. I mean, by comparison, there are roughly 73,000 vertebrates or animals with a backbone, from humans to birds and fish. And these represent less than 5% of the known animal kingdom. That's crazy,
right? It is. It really is.
Yeah, and that was according to the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. I mean, dude, there are more longhorn beetle species than bird species on the planet. That's wild. Not even that. There are about the same number of ladybug species as mammal species.
Okay, I will say that one I knew.
Oh, you did? I didn't know that. Man, there is so much unknown to the insect verse, right? It's wild.
It really is. And I know Paige mentioned the team at the San Diego Zoo Entomology Department and how awesome they are. And she's very proud of them. But I got to bring it up again. Their knowledge, the attention to detail. I mean, come on, the frass and the head cap stuff. Dedication to jumping into work that no one else has ever done before. It really takes someone special. That team is so cool.
Yeah, I mean, not only that team, too. I mean, all the partners. I mean, like U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, USDA Forest Service, California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Monarch Joint Venture. I mean, just to name a few.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's everyone out there planting native plants in their yards, like Paige was saying, how important that is. And they're being thoughtful enough to not use pesticides. All of these are great examples of how much we can accomplish when we work together.
Reach. I mean, when we look at the conservation success stories out there, it's due to collaborations and people all working together to make the Earth a healthier place for wildlife and for us.
I am so glad you mentioned that, Marco, because in just a little over a week, it's Earth Day.
Ooh, have we done an episode about Earth Day?
Not yet, Marco, but I do want to remind everyone to subscribe and tune into our next episode, in which we learn more about why Earth Day was started and how it has helped shape conservation over the years.
I'm Marco Wendt.
And I'm Rick Schwartz. Thanks for listening. For more information about the San Diego Zoo and San Diego Zoo Safari Park, go to sdzwa.org. Amazing Wildlife is a production of iHeartRadio. Our supervising producers are Nakia Swinton and Dylan Fagan. And our sound designers are Sierra Spreen and Matt Russell. For more shows from iHeartRadio, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.